Accessory number 8870, roll number 2.
Admiral Norman, reel 2. Did you see anything of the aircraft that we used?
Yes. There weren't very many. I think there were only 3 to begin with, and they were little tiny aircraft on boots, as the phrase was. And they advertised for small midshipmen to go as observers, and Queen Elizabeth supplied one, Johnny Sismore, who was one of our snotties, and I believe he got decorated after the war. But they were inexperienced, of course, they had to learn it, and they merely sat on little plates of metal as protection. They couldn't have very large ones. The reason for that was because I think we lost one of the 3 aircraft from being shot up, and the pirate was killed by a rifle. And so after that, they were served up the little metal plates to sit on. And they did quite a bit of spotting, but not very effectively in long distance, and I don't think they were much used when we bombarded over the peninsula.
Was there any difficulty in signalling between the aircraft and the ship?
Yes, that was one of the things, and if we banged off and they weren't looking in the right direction, of course, they'd probably missed the...
The sinking of the Goliath in May 1915 causes the recall of Queen Elizabeth.
Yes. As soon as the submarine was definitely established, they withdrew the Queen Elizabeth and we trotted away. We were cheered, I remember, coming out of by a ship full of troops. So the spirit was high. And I never heard, because we were only there, for something like 3 months, never heard any sort of depressing story. I think the casualties were unexpectedly high.
What was the general feeling on board the Queen Elizabeth when you were recalled from the action sent home?
Well, we were sad, I think, to be drawn out of the action, but on the other hand, quite happy to join the Grand Fleet, which we hoped was going to come in for a major action.
As a means of working the Queen Elizabeth up, do you think the Dardanelles' experience had been a great success?
It certainly taught us how to fire the guns. Whether they were effective or not, I don't know.
You return to England, and the Queen Elizabeth is attached to the Grand Fleet.
Yes, we never came back to England. We went straight up out west of Ireland and came into Scarpa Flow that way. I didn't see England again until about a year later when we gave our first leave.
Ironically, the Queen Elizabeth is refitting at the time of the Battle of Jutland.
Yeah, that's true. We were very, very sad about that, and I must say that it was a sorry sight when we saw the damaged ships coming into they came in into Rosyth, of course. That's where the ship was.
What was the general feeling in the fleet after the Battle of Jutland? There was much controversy later on.
Yeah, much controversy. At the time, no, we were very, very sad that the Germans had escaped during the night. At that early days, we couldn't understand how they'd got through. But of course, it all became clear as the years went by.
But was there a general feeling that, even in a limited sense, a victory had been won?
Oh yes, we felt that we had won all right, and that the Germans had run away.
How did the Queen Elizabeth keep in trim when she was stationed in Scarpa Flow?
Well, one of the difficulties, of course, of being kept, shall we say, on the leash like that for weeks and months at a time, was to find an occupation and keep people alert.
Did you have regular battle exercises and drills?
Yes, every week we did a sort of round of things. It was better, less monotonous when we moved to Invergordon for short spells, and then, of course, the fleet moved down to Rosyth. It was much happier then.
So how would you characterise Scarborough, though?
Very windy.
Presumably then it was a question also of keeping up the crew's morale.
Yes. Well, we had to do that, I remember the ship came up and fitted as a theatre ship, the Gurkha, and nearly every ship, I think, had a concert party, and we would get the concert ship alongside and have a party that way.
And you also went to the Ricer Lodge Club.
To the what?
The Ricer Lodge Club.
Ricer. Oh, that was, yes, where the officers in the destroyers used to land there on Hoy and walk around. I remember the family there. He was a keeper and his wife and two boys. And we found that the wife was ready to help in every way, but she hadn't got rations. And finally we fixed up a sort of Ricer Lodge Club, should we put it that way around, and we landed a certain amount of our rations, and the Mrs. Mainland used to knock up bats and things and give us a cup of tea.
The Orcadians and the Scots generally were
friendly. Oh, very friendly, and a marvellous race, I thought. Years later, in fact, in World War II, when I was then commanding a ship up there, I landed on Hoy and looked these people up. And by that time, the keeper was dead, but Mrs. Mainland was there, and I inquired over her sons, and I think she taught them, as far as I can recall. But anyway, one was, at this time, 20 years after I'd seen them, was a surgeon, I think, down in Glasgow, and the other was a captain of a merchant ship. So their early education had done pretty well for them, and that was purely Orcadian from their mother.
In these isolated conditions up in Scarborough Flow, mail and regular supplies of rations, etc., must have been very important to the crew.
Yes, we did very well, actually. We were well kept. One memory of I forget whether it was World War II or World War I, but I think it must have been World War II, the same conditions existed. And somebody had the bright idea of giving us Scotch meat and not sending up frozen Australian stuff or from abroad. And the sailors fell in with a request that they could go back to the frozen meat because it was so much easier to chop up with an axe rather than with a knife. I was very sad because we were having best Aberdeen Angus beef from the Scotch meat, and that was very, very good indeed. But however, we went back to the frozen stuff.
Sailors are generally rather conservative.
Very conservative.
Mail also was important.
Yeah, mail is very important. Well, I found that in World War II, of course, when we were abroad in the Eastern Fleet, mail was terribly important.
Why do you think that was?
I think it's the fact that when you hear on the air that there have been intensive bombing of various towns, you automatically think of your own family being in the centre of the target area, and that applies to everybody. They always feel that their family is the one being bombed. And I remember talking to my sailors saying that there are so many millions of people in London, where it's a very small percentage who are going to get hit, even if your wife does live in London.
when you were in the Scarpa Flow, in the Grand Fleet, towards the end of the war, do you think there was any serious expectation that the Germans would come out again? Or do you think their long absence had rather...
No, I think as time went on, one felt that the chances were less and less. There it is.
In 1917, you passed your exams as a lieutenant.
Not 17, was it? I became a sub. Yes, that's, I was promoted, and then I left the Queen Elizabeth and went to destroyers.
Your first ship was the Tancred.
Tancred, that's right.
And in fact, you were present while she was being constructed.
Yes, we. I stood by her at. In Glasgow, a stupid memory comes back, but one, a very happy one. We got to know one of the Sandeman family, who was a retired director, I think, or had been, had come back in the war to run the business, and he asked us in to his office after working hours down in the dockyard, and he gave us samples of whiskey, some of them dating back 50 to 100 years. He said it'd be quite all right, nobody would ever drink them, and we could put cold tea back in the bottles if we tasted them. I don't know when it was ever found out, but that we did that for about 3 weeks.
What was the purpose of standing by a ship while she was being built?
To get her fitted up, to make sure that the things were in the right place, and to help the getting all the latest information included in the ship's fittings.
Did you generally find the shipbuilders compliant to any changes you want to make?
They were very helpful, but on the other hand, they were being pushed to get on with the ships as fast as possible.
Destroyers must have been a very different sort of service. From
very different, yeah. Very happy ships. And quite different from the more rigorous, shall we say, routine of a battleship. After all, a battleship was, what, 2,000 men. You can't run that on a sort of amateur basis. It's got to be regulated.
So the destroyer would be characterised by first name basis?
Oh yes, quite a lot.
And you were in fact both a lieutenant and also you doubled as medical officer.
Oh, yes, that was my first introduction to medicine. We had a young Makelearn doctor, RNVR sub, but he was withdrawn and the captain said, come on sub, you're the MO. And I had a medicine chest, which had nothing stronger than a Dover's powder, I think, in it, and mostly number 9 pills. But we did have the odd accident to deal with, and from broken limbs and scaldings, I had quite an experience. But perhaps best forgotten.
Nevertheless, such activities, acting as medical officer, would be useful to.
Oh yes, you grow up quickly when you get that sort of responsibility.
Conditions in the small destroyers must have been very uncomfortable compared with the battleships. What were their seakeeping qualities like?
Some of them were pretty wet, but I was lucky. Tilbury was an S-class destroyer. She was a very good seaboat. But we did have some, during all ships, bad weather, quite unpleasant time. Nothing dry.
The North Sea's fairly notorious for getting bad.
Yes, it is. Yes, a short, sharp sea. And I remember taking an R&R officer he was an elderly man who'd been at sea for 30 or 40 years, I think, to bring a ship back from Bergen. And although he said he'd been at sea for 40 years, he'd never so nearly died from seasickness, because we had to get him over there fairly quickly, and he didn't appreciate the motion at all.
Was this not very exhausting?
Terribly yes, it was tiring. For a long trip in bad weather, you do get awfully tired.
And you spent a great deal of time at sea and destroying.
Yes, we did very long trips, about 4 or 5 days is usually the time, but then if you get 3 days gale, you're getting very part worn at the end of it.
Did you see any action in the destroyer?
No, I didn't, but we were very lucky. My division was sent up to Lerwick, and Mary Rose and Strongbow were two other destroyers, and who'd been up there, who were sunk by a German cruiser. Then there was a spell of another fortnight or so, and another pair of destroyers went up, and where two destroyers went up there, and we didn't have any action, but the two who relieved us were both sunk by the Germans sending up some cruisers. The job we were on was, of course, bringing convoys over from Bergen to Lerwick and then down to the British coast, and the Germans just waited and pounced. I remember when we were doing the patrol, we used to get telefunken very loud sometimes and wonder what was in the offing, but we didn't find anybody, and we got back rather gratefully, I think.
Your captain at this time was Captain Cavay.
Yes, Freddy Cavay. He had had two sinkings in comparatively short time. His first, when he was his first command was an oily ward. That was the small torpedo boat on the east coast, and he'd been torpedoed just after breakfast when he was in the loo, and the door jammed, and he couldn't get out, and he was saved by the fact that the rating on the depth charges had realized that the ship was slowing down, and the depth charges which were set to fire would kill them all when they were in the water, and he let them go while the ship still had way on. The shock splintered the door, and Freddy Cavay stepped out and was duly saved. His second command was on the west coast of Ireland, and they were rammed, cut down at night in the big swell by a ship which was astern of him, came up when on the turn, came up on the inside, and unfortunately flooded the engine room and boiler room at the same time. And so they lost all power and were only found next morning by the others, just when they were about to sink, and they were all saved. And that's, he was court-martialed the second time. When he joined my ship, he certainly was suffering, and he did his job all right, but we all knew that he'd been through the hoop.
Did you see much battle fatigue? And
well, I think a lot of the destroyer people suffered from what we call neurasthenia. I don't know what the doctors called it, but it was when a man had overtaxed himself. Some didn't suffer from it, but I think the majority of people felt it Some, of course, were just cracked up and had to be relieved.
Did you yourself come near having this
feeling? No, I was never in that responsibility. I was too young, I think. But if the war had gone on another bit, I suppose I should have had a command, and then perhaps the strain would have shown itself on me.
So it was basically the fatigue came with the responsibilities of command.
Yeah.
As a subordinate.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah. You're still in destroyers at the end of the war.
Yeah.
But you then go and take a series of examinations.
Yes, I came home at the end of 18 and was immediately sent to do the subs courses, as we call them, at Greenwich and down here in Portsmouth. At the end of that time, I was sent to the Iron Duke, back in the Mediterranean. She was flying the flag of Admiral de Robeck.
This is by 1920?
1920, yeah.
And during this time, you enter the Sea of Marmara, as you earlier described.
Yes, yeah.
And then go into the Black Sea.
Yes. We went up... I may be muddled over that. I can't remember... No, I was in first. My first visit to the Black Sea was when I was still in destroyers in 1918, because we went to the Crimea, and I remember going ashore in Sevastopol the first night we got there to try and get some fresh food. We hadn't had any vegetables for about 2 months. And I felt that we ought to do something about it. And I spent a miserable time getting back on board. I did get 2 or 3 sacks of cabbages, but some Germans were being rounded up, or were rounding up others, and there was a certain number of rifle shooting going along on the streets, and I spent a miserable quarter of a mile or so on my hands and knees, dragging sacks of cabbages that we got back without being shot. So it was all right.
Your destroyers entered the Black Sea?
Yes, we went round the various places. And then I came home, as I said. But that was, it was 18. But I remember... when we went to Sevastopol, there was a very memorable happening. One of our battleships moored at a pair of battleship buoys in the harbour, and fouled her propellers when securing to the stern buoy. They'd sent the diver down and immediately had to send a second diver down to help him because his signals were absolutely haywire. And it turned out that his mind had gone because he'd landed amongst the bodies of the Russian officers who had been thrown over the side of their battleship at that boys when the mutiny had taken place. And the second diver realized that something was wrong and helped the first one back. Whether he recovered or his mind or not, I don't know.
What was the function of this destroyer sortie into the Black Sea?
Oh, we were just going around and visiting all the harbours. We went along to Yalta and odd places. That time, there was no fighting then at all, other than the spasmodic fighting at night, which is all I can recall.
But by 1920, when you returned?
1920, then we paid official calls. I did go around to a various Samsun. We just missed, I was in hibiscus then, a small, only temporarily for a few months, but we just missed rounding up Mustafa Kemal, or Ataturk as he was called. We were trying to capture him then. But going back to the Iron Duke, I remember being sent up to, what's the name of the place? Russia, anyway, in charge of a shipload of Russians who had been incarcerated in Egypt, I think. And anyway, they, we were returning them to the Reds in exchange for a party of naval officers and under the command of Bruce Fraser, subsequently Lord Fraser, who had been captured in the Transcaucasian force, and they were being handed over at the eastern end of the Black Sea when my party were handing over these Russians at Odessa. I remember it quite well because it was terribly cold weather, and my first contact with the Russians was when their commissar came on board wearing a fur coat. It was the biggest fur coat I'd ever seen. It turned up right up over his head, the collar and so forth. And I spoke and mentioned it to him. He said, but I am the head commissar. However, the no signal had come from the other end, and so I refused to hand over my people until where I knew that the relations with the other end were going forward all right. And he came on board the next day wearing a light coat, and it was bitterly cold, and I inquired where his coat was. He said very furiously in Russian, which I couldn't understand, but the gist of it was that there had been a communal night the night before, and some friendly Russian had pinched his fur coat.
These Russians that you were returning?
Yeah.
How did they seem to view the...
The Bolsheviks, yes. Well, they came on deck, I remember, the first night when we sailed from Constantinople, and sang beautifully. And I sent the interpreter to thank them, but he smiled slightly sideways and explained to me that they were singing the red flag specially for my benefit. And I said, well, I don't mind what they're singing when they sing so beautifully.
You were shipping the returning Russian prisoners in a hired merchant.
In a merchant ship, yeah.
So except for your brief period on the destroyer Hibiscus, you spent your time in the Black Sea on the Iron Duke.
Iron Duke, yeah.
Did you have any dealings with the Turks on shore from, must have been used bases on the...
I personally didn't, but of course we were in constant touch.